NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who remembers the 35 sweet goodbyes before he was sent up to Annandale. Here is the captain.
I remember all the hellos and goodbyes. It's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week, we are very happy to be featuring Double Orange Starfish. This is a New England-style pale ale by the brilliant folks over at Aslin Beer Company, located in Alexandria, Virginia. This is a double India pale ale, double dry hopped, with Citra and Galaxy hops. And because it's a double, we get an ABV of 8.3% garage grade 4. And a half bottle caps out of 5. And let's give some thanks and praise to our friends for helping us out with this week's beer run. First up, a shout out to Zach Akvon from Cave Spring, Georgia. And last but certainly not least, we have Bo Berry in Chicago. Everyone we mentioned, they went to our website, truecrimegarage.com, clicked on the pint glass, and filled up the old garage fridge for this week's shows. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. Want to give a big shout out to Birmingham City fans all around the world. Go Blues. I know we're in 20th place right now, but onwards and upwards, my friends. And make sure you go to truecrimegarage.com, sign up on the mailing list so you're in the know. If you're on the mailing list, then you would have got an email with a promo code so you could save some money and get some swag in the podcast store. And Colonel, that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. From the late, great Dr. Robert Keppel's book, Signature Killers. There is a mystery surrounding the nature of signature murder. It perplexed investigators long before I began my career, and well before the behavioral science unit of the FBI, and the profilers who worked cases of serial killers for local police. The patterns of a signature murder crime scene are so bizarre that they send shivers down your back. Even if you've seen hundreds of crime scenes. What is obvious at these sites is the meticulous care the killer took posing or positioning the body, the precise way a bondage killer tied his victim, the animalistic frenzy with which a killer delivered blunt trauma wounds to a corpse, or the murderer's precise placement of pricking wounds. You can sense the time and the care each killer took. And that is what makes you feel the most nauseated. Many police agencies want to turn away from such scenes and hope that a crime like this is a one-time only occurrence. But the more experienced among us realize that the type of guy who leaves this kind of scene kills again and again. Legendary profiler Roy Hazelwood called these guys the Great White Sharks. From his book Dark Dreams, just as the great white shark is the renowned predator of the oceans, the sexual sadist is the most dangerous and cunning of all aberrant criminals. He also presents the greatest challenge to law enforcement. This is True Crime Garage. A series of murders known for more than three decades as the Colonial Parkway murders started with two young innocent folks who we believe crossed paths with a killer or killers on or near the Colonial Parkway on the evening of Saturday, October 11th, back in 1986. What would follow would be three more double murders that shared many similarities with the first murder of two. So four sets of double murders, eight innocent young folks all killed in a little less than a three-year time frame. Two of the four cases directly involve the Colonial Parkway. The other two take place not too far from the parkway, with speculation that the parkway was likely either traveled by the victim and or the killer or killers on those dark nights when the murders took place. We covered these cases back in episodes 226 and 227, and recently, for those who are nasty, we provided an update on our other show, Off the Record, available by subscription. This was just last month, following the new information and answers that finally came about early this year regarding two of the Parkway victims and a third murder, which is a much less known case, that now will forever be linked to the Parkway cases. A little bit about the Parkway itself. This week's case takes place in historic Virginia on a scenic parkway, an area treasured for its colonial history and natural beauty. This is a gorgeous 23-mile stretch of road that belongs to the National Park Service, a desirable drive linking the three points of Virginia's historic triangle: Jamestown, Williamsburg, and Yorktown. A roadway shielded from commercial development that does not allow semi-trucks, it is toll-free, and has speed limits of just 35 to 45 miles per hour. It is also popular with tourists due to the James River and York River ends of the parkway, an area that many have and will go out of their way to see and travel. But then, starting in 1986, there was great cause to avoid this area, especially after dark, because of the four brutal and senseless double murders of young couples. Now, for the news that we got back in January, this was almost news of the best kind, Captain. News that one could hope for. In a cold case, one of the double murders was finally solved this year.
News that we like to call got him news.
We were hoping for all four, of course, but then you have to go back to something that has been up for debate since these cases started. Big question: were all of these cases committed by the same perpetrator? One side of that argument is nothing of great significance regarding the forensic evidence is able to 100% tie these four cases together. The other side of that table, we have experts with the Virginia State Police and the FBI that say the four cases simply share far too many similarities that they are likely connected. Now here comes the very interesting exercise of sort of reverse engineering these cases. Before, we had four double sets of murders, and we had suspects. Now we have proof positive that we got a guy that committed two of these eight Parkway murders. So how does he stack up when compared to the previously discussed suspects? Does he look better for this than they do? And how do we cross-compare the remaining three unsolved double murders with the recently solved one? And can we draw any conclusions from there? On Off the Record last month, we looked at this killer and we spoke about what we know about him at the time and the other murder that he was connected to. We spoke about what this could mean for the other Parkway murders and our thoughts on him being the likely perpetrator in those other three cases. Today, what we are going to do is to speak a little bit more in depth about how likely we think he could be the perpetrator in those other three cases. And we also want to talk about some other things that we've learned about this mysterious man. And most importantly, Captain, I want to expand this timeline out a little bit more from beyond the 3 years involving the Parkway murders. What other murders could this man be responsible for and why?
Well, who was this killer and how did law enforcement link him to these cases and another murder case as well?
Yeah, so we go back to January, Captain. This is when we learned from the Virginia State Police that Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. was responsible for the murders of Robin Edwards and David Knobling. They are two of the so-called Colonial Parkway victims. Alan Wilmer is also responsible for the death of Teresa Howell. Now, we said got him, but let's temper that excitement a little bit, right? Because right. Alan Wilmer is a dead man. So there wasn't that wonderful got him moment. There will be no trial, no sentencing, no victim impact statements given, no punishment carried out for Alan Wilmer.
Well, maybe I'm an awful person, but I don't mind when an evil person dies.
The big question is, did he kill others? I think right. So, and we will talk about who, but if he did, he took those secrets to the grave.
Right.
Now, this is from our friends at Oxygen, filling us in on some of the information that we covered on Off the Record and some information that our great listeners may already be aware of. But the people at Oxygen, to sum it up, they say on Monday, January 8th, 2024, the Virginia State Police and multiple law enforcement agencies announced a suspect in the 1987 double murder of David L. Knobling, he was 20 years old, and Robin M. Edwards, who was 14, both of whom were shot to death near a wildlife refuge in Isle of Wight County. The Knobling Edwards murders were believed to be part of a cluster of double murders between 1986 and 1989 called the Colonial Parkway murders. Officials say DNA helped them narrow in on suspect Alan W. Wilmer Sr., Alan Wade Wilmer Sr., of Northern Neck, Virginia, not just for the Knobling Edwards homicides, but also for the 1989 rape and strangulation murder of 29-year-old Teresa, who also went by Terry, Lynn Spa Howe. So Teresa Howe is how we will refer to her going forward. Lieutenant Colonel Tim Lyon and Director of the Virginia State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigations thanked the victims' families for decades of patience and understanding, adding, quote, "Only those who have suffered the loss of a child in this way can truly understand the depth of their sorrow and the frustration over not knowing who was responsible for taking their loved one's life in such a violent and cruel way," end quote. He goes on to say, "I do hope the identification of the killer brings some sense of closure and peace for them." Wilmer died in 2017. As we pointed out, this means he won't face prosecution for his crimes. Now, what else do we know about Alan Wilmer? This is from the good folks over at the Virginia Gazette. So Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. died alone. You said, Captain, that you don't mind that he's dead. I don't either. It does help some things. You do wish that he would have been identified sooner and would have served some form of punishment for his horrific acts. But I guess we're going to take a little bit of glee in the fact that he died alone. Like, it sounds like he was estranged from his family. So he died alone in his Northern Neck home more than 6 years ago. Nobody found him for weeks. In fact, it was a delivery driver who finally spotted an open door to Wilmer's home, this on December 15th, 2017.
Well, the guy was such a piece of shit that nobody was looking for him. Nobody was in contact with him.
Doesn't sound like he was in communication with anybody. So this delivery driver decides, all right, I'm going to do a little bit of snooping here, opens up a door, looks inside, sees this man dead, and calls the Lancaster County Sheriff's Office. Because of the condition of the body, the state medical examiner's office was called in to investigate. This is when they collected Wilmer's DNA.
Right.
This is because they wanted to positively identify the decomposing remains that were found, and they were hoping to determine the cause of death. Now, we should note here that Wilmer was 63 years of age when he died, and according to what I could find, it sounds like he died of a hardening of the arteries. But the DNA that examiners collected in 2017 ended up being crucial evidence a few years later, and that's when the FBI and Virginia State Police sought Wilmer's genetic material as part of their investigation into the Colonial Parkway murders.
Well, and they did this because he was on their radar before.
Yes, and I believe that's going to be surprising news for a lot of people out there listening. So Wilmer was never a convicted felon, so his genetic profile was never submitted to DNA databases while he was alive.
Right.
Here we have a quote. It says, it was lucky that there was DNA taken at his death. This according to a law enforcement source with knowledge of the case, adding there was a little bit of fortune here that his DNA was on record and wasn't in the ground or by the wayside. This is really interesting to kind of sit and ponder for a little bit, because, you know, one thing that I love to repeat on here is the reminder, the sad, disturbing reminder that often in these cases, the victims never get lucky, because they don't get away. They don't escape with their lives. They don't live to tell the story. They don't live to turn the person in that assaulted them or attempted to harm them.
Right.
The killer gets lucky, especially in these cases that go cold. The killer gets lucky for a multitude of reasons. It could be because the evidence was lost, or they happened to be able to commit a crime at a time where no eyewitnesses were witness what happened. And you can go on and on with that list. But here we have the very rare situation where something that's kind of happenstance takes place, triggers a domino effect of collect this individual's DNA. And as you said, Captain, and I believe several of our listeners will be surprised to find out, this guy wasn't totally off the radar. He was somebody that the police had looked at before. In fact, at one time, he was the prime suspect in the Colonial Parkway murders, not just the murders that he's been definitively connected to today in 2024, the Noblings Edwards murder.
But possibly all of them.
At one time, he was the prime suspect in all of those murders. And we're going to get into that detail here in just a second, but that's what's interesting. So at some point, they must have decided to circle the wagons, right? And they're like, oh, we should find out if this guy who's in our file already, who we were looking at back in the day, who, mind you, was air quotes cleared.
Yeah.
Maybe we take put some fresh eyes on this and take a new look at some of the information we've already collected, dust off those files, and see if the guy, or at least a person who's responsible for one of the sets of murders out of the four, is already in our file. A lot of times, you know, we turn on the TV these days, we listen to a podcast, and we're hearing about every few weeks, DNA genealogy detective work has definitively linked so-and-so to the murders of a person from 30, 40, 50 years ago.
And I was saying this a couple of years ago. I mean, every year we're going to see more and more cases get solved. There were two cases that were solved yesterday. Two cold cases solved yesterday because of this. And because of this science, we're going to have so many, we're going to have a higher percentage of cold cases that get solved in the next 5 years.
Well, the technology, it would stand to reason that the technology would only get better. That's only going to help in these cases, especially ones where they tell us that the DNA, we're waiting to test it. We're waiting for technology to catch up to the evidence that we have. So yeah, you're right. It's only going to continue to snowball, hopefully, right? And here we find out that it is not like a lot of the headlines that we see today where it's like, this guy was never a suspect. He was never somebody that we looked at. Here it's the opposite, where we learn Wilmer was not only looked at, but was determined to be by several persons involved in the investigation as the prime suspect. Numero uno, prime suspect.
Yeah, this guy is the apex predator. They had him as their number one suspect. Because look, it's not a scenario where some random guy died and they were like, well, he was an asshole to his family. He was a real dick mouth. So we're going to have to test his DNA to see if he did any crimes. That's not what happens. This guy was number one suspect, and they go, well, he just happened to die. We have his DNA. We probably should test it against some of the evidence we have in these other cases.
Yeah, he was only 63 when he died in 2017, and it sounds like in 2017, it's a little murky how close they were looking at him then. Here's the information that we get, and you can make of this what you will. The official record is DNA was linked to three killings in June of 2023. Okay, now let's take this back a couple years prior. So about 2 years ago, law enforcement and forensic analysts determined that the unknown killer in the Isle of Wight case also killed a woman in Hampton 2 years later. So the official word is, or statement from Virginia State Police spokeswoman Corinne Geller, was that we had a common suspect. So they knew at that time, 2 years prior, that we have a common suspect. The same person that killed these two individuals also killed this other individual. So, but that person was unknown to them. That person was a ghost to them. He had not been identified. So Teresa Lynn Howell, age 29, who was last seen leaving the Zodiac Club, that was a then popular night spot in East Mercury, on East Mercury Boulevard. So she's leaving at about 2:30 a.m. on July 1st, 1989. The Hampton police said that construction workers found her body about 7 or 8 hours later in a wooded area. This is in the 500 block of Butler Farm Road. The reason why they find her is the site was being developed as part of the Hampton Roads Center. They determined early on that she had been sexually assaulted and strangled. Then fast forward to 1995, the Hampton police actually end up charging a different man, not Wilmer, who was still alive at the time. They charged a different man with Howe's murder and considered him for capital murder charge. This was a 32-year-old man. I guess he spent about 4 months in custody for this before being cleared on DNA evidence. So the science saved this 32-year-old man from going away forever.
Yeah, thank God the science saved him.
Then that case remains unsolved for all of these years.
But like you said, to put it in simple terms, we have this double homicide. We have DNA there. We have this single homicide. We have DNA there. But we know that the DNA matches. But yep, like you said, both we don't cases. Know who it is.
We don't. Yeah, we can't connect that to a good suspect. And then it's in June of last year that they put the Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. name to all three of those homicides. And then in January of 2024, making the announcement publicly that we've closed out three cold case murders. Here's a story behind the scenes of the shoe industry. The stark contrast between a premium shoemaker and those riding on massive advertising budgets. Enter G-Defy Shoes, a true departure from the ordinary, backed by a groundbreaking clinical study conducted by UCLA. G-Defy stands apart with its patented and meticulously designed sole construction. This isn't just about absorbing shock. It's like your shoes giving you a high five with every step, boosting you forward and adding a pep to your stroll. G-Defy isn't just grabbing any old sole off the shelf. They're on a mission to boost the biomechanics of how shoes work and foster a movement that nurtures your body. G-Defy's investment is channeled into the foundational construction of the shoe, a device that alleviates pain and serves as natural footwear to preempt further wear and tear. I love the Verso Shock sole, spring system, and the G-Defy shoes are great for my back, knees, and joints. And arch support is removable. I can actually get pure comfort for more than 8 hours with this shoe. I'm not just walking on a cloud with my new G-Defy shoes. I'm walking on cloud nine. Visit G-Defy.com now because your feet deserve more than just another pair of shoes. And here's a little extra love for True Crime Garage listeners. Use the discount code GARAGE for an exclusive $30 off orders of $150 or more. Yep, you heard it right. A little gift from G-Defy to your feet. Experience the miracle that is G-Defy, where comfort meets innovation. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties, bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair shares of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. Set up reoccurring or one-time chores, customize to your family's needs, and connect them with allowances to reward your kids for a job well done. Meanwhile, your kids build financial literacy and independence by learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app also comes with an in-app financial literacy game called Level Up that helps your kids build money confidence through videos, bite-sized challenges, mini games, and more. More than 6 million parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices. I wish we had Greenlight when I was a kid. I'd do chores and they would forget to pay me. With the Greenlight app, I could say, hey, guys, you haven't paid me yet. Also, what a great way to incentivize your kids. You get good grades? Well, transfer some money with the Greenlight app. The Greenlight app is so easy to use and so easy to set up. And you're going to be able to teach your kids how to be financially responsible so they can earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/garage. That's greenlight.com/garage to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/garage. It's time to have the big money talk with your kids. Do it with Greenlight. Check out greenlight.com/garage today. All right, we are back, you filthy animals. Cheers to you all. Cheers to you, Colonel.
Yeah, try to keep it clean out there, animals.
Yeah, dirty, dirty bananas.
If this update is hitting your ears for the first time, you know where we're going next, because what we have is Virginia State Police and the FBI. They want to know more about this Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. They want to know about his life, his timeline. So here's a statement. The FBI continues to have multiple open investigations that we're looking at to see if Mr. Wilmer is connected to include other cases. A spokesperson for the FBI says, while he may or may not be connected to other cases, we are still pursuing justice for victims. So really what they're talking about, obviously, is he connected to the other Colonial Parkway murders?
Right. That would be the most likely.
That's the first thing that everybody's going to grasp and comprehend from this statement and from the press conference that took place announcing that this guy's guilty.
Right.
And they're not saying, like, what they are saying is the DNA evidence definitively means it. So there's no nice way of putting this, but in both cases, there was a rape, sexual assault, and a murder. They have his DNA from those rapes. Now we know that he's done these three murders. How many other murders, even beyond the Colonial Parkway cases, could he be connected to? What little that we know about this man, Alan Wade Wilmer Sr., is we know he has a son. That's why I keep saying senior. We know that he has a brother. We know that he lived with his brother for a period of time. It sounds like he may have lived with his brother on and off for years. We know that he drove a truck. He owned a boat for a while. We know that he worked as a waterman for a while. He worked the waters off of the coast of Virginia and probably even down into the North Carolina area. At some point, he switches careers. You know, keep in mind, for most of his life, Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. worked for himself. That's one of the things that makes his timeline so difficult for law enforcement. So he works as a waterman, and then later he owns what I believe is called Best Tree Service, where he goes around and, you know, cutting down trees and things of that nature.
Which one means he traveled often.
Yeah. And sometimes, look, with the water business and with the tree business, in both scenarios, you're kind of chasing the work, right? Like he was in the oyster business. So you're chasing the oysters, essentially. In the tree business, yeah, you can just drive around to random neighborhoods and say, hey, would you like me to trim that tree? Or you could get calls to your Best Tree Service and show up for an appointment to trim a tree or cut down a tree or to take apart a fallen tree. Let's go to that fallen tree idea. Because one thing that these tree guys do is they chase storms. When a storm comes in and it damages and knocks down a bunch of trees, you can drive out to that location and get a bunch of work quick.
Yeah, this makes it a lot more difficult for law enforcement. It's not like when they're looking for the Scranton Strangler and they have to go interview Michael Scott. They go, well, where do you work? At the paper company. What days a week do you work? So you know where his location is every day. Every day that he was at work, he's at Dunder Mifflin. This guy, every day of the week, he's at a different job site.
And keep in mind what we do know now that is definitive is that he committed murders in two different counties, Hampton County and Isle of Wight County. And we know this from the three murders that police are saying he absolutely committed. One thing that is will work in law enforcement's favor here, because what this is a big ask, right? You're asking the public, go back in your mind, and can you recall some stuff from the mid to late 80s, even early 90s, where you had an interaction with this guy? We're trying to place where he was, what was he up to. So the one things that they have, a few things that are working in their favor, right, is he owns a boat. Not everybody and their brother owns a boat. He owns a boat. The Denny Wade is the name of his boat. The truck that he drove and used for a long, he used this truck for a long period of time. It's a unique truck. It's an older model truck. And we'll get into that description here in a minute. But the other thing, too, that I think that police and law enforcement might have in their favor here, Captain, is he has what I would refer to as a distinctive physical appearance. Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. was 5'5" tall. So he's quite short, but he's also quite muscular.
Yeah.
Caucasian male. Who is nowhere near average height. And these guys, one thing we know is these guys always have someone who got away. And it doesn't even have to, the situation does not even have to escalate to a high level of violence. But these guys always have someone who got away. Now, we know that he had someone who got away, and that's how he ends up on police radar to begin with back in the late 80s. Alan Wade Wilmer Sr., we have, when these Parkway murders are taking place, there are several persons that contact law enforcement and they say, look, I was out on the Parkway, me and my girlfriend, or I was out on the Parkway by myself and I was approached by someone. Someone came up to my vehicle and approached me, and he's was this short white guy, muscular looking white guy. And, oh, he drove this truck, which is an older model truck. And, in fact, it's a 1966 truck. So keep in mind, this truck's over 20 years old at the time of the Colonial Parkway murders. So that in itself will make it unique.
Yeah, sticks out like a sore thumb.
A lot of times you can give a great description to police regarding the headlights. If you look at this truck, it's got the old rounded headlights. It was, we have pictures of it being painted blue with white lettering on the sides. Now, we can't speak to what color this truck was for the entirety that it was in its use. It could have been multiple colors over the years. We cannot say that that white lettering was on the sides of the truck for all of its use. We do know that he had that tree service, which would make sense. We've all seen those in our neighborhoods, the trucks that drive around that have the contractor's business name and telephone number or website on the side of the vans or trucks. And that's what appears to be here, Best Tree Service. But they get several people that come forward, and he had a vanity plate. E.M. Rawl is what his vanity plate stated. E.M. Rawl. So you have this information that's coming in, and it points to a very specific person, right? It's not like, oh, now we're just looking for some short white guy. No, we get a description of this truck that's got the toolboxes in the back, and it's old, and it's got vanity plates. And so very quickly, they hone in on this guy.
Yeah, it says Best Tree Service, cutting down trees, and also murder.
They're able to find this truck and find the man that it belongs to.
But he's also a hunter. So he'd be out in those areas anyways. He would have knowledge of different weapons. There's a lot of things that kind of point to the idea that he's a good suspect.
Yeah, they pull up to go talk to him, and they decide, hey, let's not pull up so fast, and let's not go question this guy so fast. He's outside. He's doing something. Let's see what he's doing. And when they first cross paths with this man, they spot him painting his truck. And this is shortly after some of the murders and then the disappearances. They believe, of course, their detective Spidey sense is going to kick in and they're going to go, this guy looks like he's trying to cover up some evidence, you know, that he's trying to hide this truck from us and from other people by disguising this truck. So armed with this information, they get a search warrant from a judge. They go and search his dwelling, where he's living, where he's staying. I believe when they make this search, he's living with his brother at the time. We should go into the lifestyle a little bit more that we know about Alan. But
yeah, so he works for himself all these years, but it didn't seem like he had two nickels to rub together to get his own place.
Well, some of that comes back to the waterman job. So you'll see, like, this is a very common work in this area of the country where a lot of people, especially a lot of men, work in this line of work. Most of them don't own boats. Most of them are going out with a captain, right? They're going out with somebody that owns a boat and they're part of a team. This man, yeah, for most of the time, it seems that he worked alone and had the ability to do so because he had his own boat. And from my understanding, Captain, what he would do is he would live with his brother, who has been married for a long time. And so I'm assuming he's living with his, not just his brother, but his brother's family. But he would live with them for periods of time. But then he would also go out when the seasons would hit, when the water work would be especially busy, he would live on his boat for days or even maybe a couple weeks at a time.
Right.
So his comings and goings are very difficult to nail down because of his line of work over the years and his living situation.
Well, yeah. And if he went missing for a week, his brother and his brother's family is not going to be concerned because they're just like, well, he probably is out on the boat working.
This is all very interesting because I want to go back to our 2018 coverage. We were discussing theories. And discussing the theories that we thought were more favorable, more likely, and that there were a lot of theories to be considered. We had limited time to present them to you, so we only discussed the ones that we thought were the most likely. And this is exact wording from my notes from the 2018 coverage of the Colonial Parkway murders. It says, one theory is the so-called Waterman theory. And I wrote, this is a theory that I find extremely interesting. This theory was developed largely because, one, the locations of the murders were all near waterways, and two, the diesel fuel that was used in the first set of murders is not super common for motorists, but is very common for boats, to power boats. In this scenario, one of the first crimes, there was diesel fuel that was used to attempt to cover up the crime scene, cover up and burn some of the evidence. And it was theorized that, well, a person with a boat, a person on a boat, this is something that they would have with them already. They wouldn't have to make a special trip to go and get this item, diesel fuel, and attempt to use it to cover up their crimes. The other thing that made the Waterman theory interesting was if you look at where some of these crimes take place, or at least as far as where the victims were left.
Right.
In some scenarios, traveling by boat would also explain how the killer would manage to escape without being seen, walking along the parkway, driving along the parkway, having to risk leaving his car. Yeah, having to risk leaving his vehicle parked somewhere while he's attacking people.
Yeah, because if you see one car on the side of the road, it doesn't throw a lot of red flags up in your head. But if you see two cars and one's not a service car, you start going, well, that's a little odd, especially if you don't see anybody around. Normally, if you see two cars pulled over on the side of the road, it's somebody that stopped to help the other individual, but you see those individuals out by their car. So if you just see, here's a car, it's parked, there's nobody around, doesn't bring up that many red flags to me. So for those that haven't been following or haven't listened to those episodes, let's give a little refresher of the four main cases.
Yeah, so let's go back to the Parkway case timeline. We'll start at October 12th, 1986. Now, it's believed that our two victims here were attacked the night before, that they crossed paths with their killer the night before. Their bodies were not found until the following day, fairly early in the day. So on October 12, 1986, the bodies of Kathleen Thomas, age 27, and Rebecca Dowski, age 21, they were found at a pull-off on the parkway. Kathleen Thomas, she owned a Honda Civic. It was one of those hatchbacks. A jogger, he's out running, and, well, I guess he's not running, he's jogging, technically. He spots this Honda Civic that is like down in an embankment. This embankment goes down to the water. And so he thinks he sees like, oh, this is just somebody wrecked their car. They were probably drunk driving or lost control of their vehicle and probably abandoned the vehicle. No, he gets a little close to the vehicle and figures out that's not the scenario at all. And now we're bringing in the authorities. It was determined by investigators. They find the bodies of these poor young women inside the vehicle. And it was determined by the investigators that most likely after the two were killed, that the killer attempted to push the vehicle over the embankment, like trying to conceal the, can I push this car into the water? If I can at least push it down to the point where it rolls down this embankment, it would at least be concealed from the roadway and not likely to be spotted unless somebody were to go into that pull-off and park nearby or be walking near very nearby. The killer also tried unsuccessfully to set the vehicle on fire. And this is where the diesel fuel comes into play. The victims had been strangled and their throats were cut.
I wonder if he is using diesel fuel for his boat.
Yes, that's the suspicion here. And that's right. That was one of the keys that got them to the Waterman theory. It wasn't an overly popular theory at the time, but nonetheless, it was one of the theories. And as we now know,
a correct theory.
Well, should at least factor in big time because we know that a waterman was responsible for two of the murders. Unfortunately, with the Kathleen Thomas and Rebecca Dowski, the first in the series, Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. has not been definitively connected to those murders. We don't need to get into the complications and some of the issues with each of these four investigations. If you want to get into that, into the weeds with that business, go back and listen to the 2018 coverage because we certainly go through all of the hurdles that came along with each of these cases and the complications of the investigations.
All the hurdles and all the minutia.
Then we go to September 20th, 1987. So we're not quite 1 year from the Thomas Dowski murders. This is the David Nobling, Robin Edwards murders, the ones that would be connected to Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. through the DNA evidence. So David Nobling's truck is found abandoned in a parking lot. The door, one of the doors, at least one of the doors is open. The radio is left on. David's wallet is found on the dashboard. 3 days later, Robin Edwards and David Nobling's bodies were discovered near the shoreline of the Ragged Island Wildlife Refuge. This is in Isle of Wight County. That was a couple miles downriver from the James River Bridge where Nobling's pickup was found unattended in that small parking lot. Both of these victims were shot to death. And Robin Edwards, as we know, was sexually assaulted. So this is where you can see when we just go through a short description, a brief description of both of these crimes, you see some similarities and you also see some stark differences. What's interesting here, Captain, is Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. was not a prime suspect back in 1987 for the Nobling Edwards murders. But we know from the DNA evidence that he was the perpetrator of those two murders. He comes onto the police radar after the third set of crimes. So April 10th, 1988. Now we are roughly a year and a half from the first case. We have Keith Call, age 20, and Cassandra Haley. She's age 18. These two go missing. They attended a college party. We should point out that in a lot of these cases, in each of these cases, in fact, still to this day, all of these persons are referred to as couples. Yes, they're coupled together because they're hanging out that night, but Keith Call and Cassandra Haley, as far as everyone's considered, they were not in a relationship together. They're just friends that were hanging out, attending the same party that night. So they go missing.
It's something that people have disputed, but...
Well, I think that's important to point out, and here's why. Because a lot of times when people try to come up with their own little offender profile,
right,
here it's easy for persons to go, well, he was targeting couples. Well, you can't say that. There's no evidence to say that. Yes, we have four different situations where couples are killed. Two people that are coupled together are killed together. But I don't think it would be obvious to everybody out there that Kathleen Thomas and Rebecca Dowski in 1986 were in fact a couple. They're both women.
Right.
It wouldn't be obvious to a stranger that they're an actual couple. Now, the other three, you have a male and female in each case. And so one could make the assumption that they're couples. But as said, Keith Call and Cassandra Haley, if the person responsible knew them, they would know that in fact they weren't a couple. So you can't say in your profile that they were targeting persons that were involved in a romantic relationship, a couple. So they go missing. You'll hear the similarities here with case number three compared to number two. Keith Call's Toyota Celica is found on the Colonial Parkway. Inside the vehicle are several articles of clothing belonging to Keith and Cassandra, and also found are the car keys. They are both presumed dead. Their bodies have never been found. This is the only case out of the four where the bodies have never been recovered. In all of these three cases so far, I want to point out one strong, strong similarity. It would appear that whoever abducted, because that's what you have to do, you have to abduct and control and then kill these individuals. Whoever abducted these individuals, they manipulated the vehicle in all three scenarios. Now, it's difficult for the captain and I to sit here and go, okay, the victim may have done this with the vehicle or the perpetrator may have done it. But what we have here is we have victims' family members that are saying David Nobling would have never left his truck in the way that it was found. Door open, radio right on, his wallet on the dashboard.
I don't think most people would leave their car like that.
Well, in the Keith Call Cassandra Haley case, the most recent one that we're discussing, the 1988 case, police take a look at this and they're like, oh yeah, their clothing's in the car and the car keys are in there too. They're out skinny dipping somewhere. No, it's April 10th and it was very cold. They're not in cold water skinny dipping together. If they wanted to find themselves in a situation, they could have just went and parked the car somewhere or went to someone's home or apartment. Those two, unfortunately, as we said, have never been found. And then obviously, as far as manipulating the vehicle goes, it's obvious in the first case. I mean, the pushed over an embankment, and doused with diesel fuel.
Yeah, that's not how I leave my car.
One of the bodies stuffed into the back in the hatchback. Yeah, so somebody's doing something with these vehicles, and it's all a part of all three of these crimes. And then we go, this is where we have, if all four of these are 100% connected, this is when we have a bit of a delay. So April 10th, 1988, Keith Call, Cassandra Haley case. Now we're going to go all the way out to September 5th, 1989. So well over a year later, we have Anna Maria Phelps, age 18, Daniel Lauer, age 21. They disappeared from an Interstate 64 rest stop in New Kent County. So keep in mind, we're bringing another county into the equation. When we look at this potential series of murders, Lauer's vehicle, which is a Chevy Nova, is found on the westbound exit ramp, keys in the ignition. So they go missing. The vehicle's found the next day. The bodies are not found for 6 weeks. So 6 weeks later, after the vehicle is found, the bodies are discovered by hunters out in a wooded area. Phelps had been stabbed to death, and Lauer's body was too decomposed to determine the cause of death. Now, with this vehicle, again, keys in the ignition, was found on the westbound exit ramp. The reason why we can say in this case that the vehicle may have been manipulated, the crime scene may have been altered. Heck, they may have been intercepted by the killer elsewhere, and then this vehicle moved and left on the westbound exit ramp on Interstate 64. Why? Because they were not westbound. They were not heading in that direction. The vehicle was facing in the absolute opposite 180 degree direction of the direction that they would have been traveling. So where and how, again, in this scenario, as with the others, the vehicle is found positioned or in a location that doesn't make any sense to anyone that knows these people or to law enforcement.
Well, it seemed like this killer wanted to make the bodies disappear. So then obviously you don't have that evidence, but they also wanted to make the cars disappear, but that's sometimes harder to do.
I wouldn't be surprised, too, if there are things with some of these vehicles or thoughts of the perpetrator that they wanted to maybe plant the idea that the vehicle was the motive, that the vehicle was stolen.
Right.
Or an attempt to steal the vehicle. I can see that with some of the evidence and some of the details of each one of these cases. But we still have the Hampton murder to discuss, as well as other possible cases that we can connect Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. to.
Want to thank everybody for joining us here in the garage each and every week. Make sure you tell a friend. Make sure you call your mother and say, "Hey, Mom, are you listening to True Crime Garage? Because if you're not, then I disown you." Until tomorrow.
Be good, be kind, and don't quit.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.